This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Felicity Finch. You may know me as Ruth in The Archers. I'm just asking for a few seconds of your time before you listen to the Woman's Hour podcast. This Christmas, thousands of people across the UK will be without a safe place to call home. But you can help change that. St Martin's helps ensure that people experiencing homelessness can find and keep a safe place to live. Your gift could support someone to take the next step towards a more secure future. Please support the BBC Radio 4 Christmas Appeal with St Martin in the Fields by donating online on the Radio 4 Christmas Appeal website. Whether you give every year or if this is your first, thank you. Now enjoy your podcast.
Hello, I'm Anita Rani and welcome to Woman's Hour from BBC Radio 4. Good morning. I have a podcast recommendation for you today, Sweet Bobby. It's a story about a catfishing incident. A woman was duped into believing she was in a relationship with a man online for 10 years. But what she discovered to be the truth is sad, shocking and unbelievable. And you'll be hearing about it from the woman at the heart of the story, Kirit Usi, shortly. Now, last week I promised festive food every Friday in December and I'm sticking to my promise because I'm greedy, quite frankly. I'm permanently hungry. And today, Keisha Sakara, who runs Caribe, a Caribbean pop-up, will be dishing up mouth-watering recipes. So make sure you've got a biscuit to hand to stave off the inevitable hunger pangs. And of course, I would like to hear from you and your alternative Christmas eats. If you are going to be doing an alternative Christmas, you can text me on 84844. You can also go to our social media. It's at BBC Woman's Hour. And if you fancy dropping me an email, go to our website. For me, it's turkey, all the trimmings and a variety of chilli sauces. And feel free to get in touch with your thoughts and experiences about any of the stories on today's show. Now, ever have a flutter on the horses? Well, the world of horse racing has been facing up to its own Me Too moment this week. A light has been shone on the bullying and harassment endured by professional jockey Bryony Frost on and off the track. Another jockey called Robbie Dunn has been banned for 18 months with 3 months suspended after he was found guilty of the charges. An independent panel found him in breach of all 4 counts of conduct prejudicial to the reputation of horse racing. 3 charges of violent or improper conduct are yet to be considered. The panel heard evidence over several days about a weighing room culture. The weighing room is where jockeys get help with their saddles. It follows charges brought by the British Horse Racing Authority. Well, with me to talk about this is Gay Kellyway, who's the first woman to ride a winner at Royal Ascot and is a race trainer. Gail, very good morning. Welcome to Woman's Hour. You were at an award ceremony last night, the Racehorse Owners Awards, and Bryony was there. She knows you're on Woman's Hour this morning. What did she say to you?
Yes, good morning. I was at the Racehorse Owners Awards last night, which is awards for national hunt and flat horses to various people's horses. And Bryony was there and I had a long chat with her and she's a pretty tough cookie. I must say the key point here, it wasn't a one-off bullying from an angry jockey. This has been going on for basically over a year. And Bryony was pretty upbeat. She got a standing ovation when our horse won Steeplechaser of the Year. And she went up on the stage with the owner, and everybody stood up and clapped her, male and female. She has strong support from the owners. She just feels that this will, she feels some of the colleagues will be very hostile towards her for a long time. But I reassured her this will pass, and what she has done is good for our sport and women in racing and coming into racing. So I think what she's done, stood up and been heard, which a lot of girls are too frightened to do so, is a good thing. Good thing for our sport.
And when she said that she feels lots of colleagues will be hostile towards her, what did she mean? What was she talking about?
Well, they won't talk to her. They ignore her and sort of shun her, which they have been doing, actually. And some of the valets at a meeting would refuse to help her. So, like you said, it's a bit of a boys' club a bit in the weighing room. And
yeah, what do you mean by weighing room culture? What goes on in the weighing room?
What goes on in the weighing room is that if someone, say, for instance, you're riding in a race and it's the heat of the moment and you've come across another jockey and they can really give you some bollocking and have a go at you. But it's done and dusted. But they can continuously have a go and then another jockey have a go at you. But you can't report it. You're too scared to report it. And they keep on at you and won't leave you alone. And it stays within the weighing room. You know, you can't tell a steward, you can't tell the outside world. But I think if we all say things at the heat of the moment, but I think if it's a one-off thing, it's not that important. But I think if it's constant bullying that, you know, he wouldn't leave her alone and had a go at every moment he could, I think that's a worry. And we want to encourage young people to come into to racing and enjoy it and feel comfortable when they come in within the weighing room. They have valets, but they have male valets. They don't have any women valets. And the valets actually look after the jockeys and get the saddles ready when they're rushing in and out and riding in these races. And horse racing is quite dangerous. We're riding thoroughbreds over fences, which is much more dangerous than flat racing. And they do have, you know, there could be two or three falls in each race. And the jockeys have to get up and it's providing they're okay to ride in the next race. But the valets actually look after and make sure their saddles are ready and the silks are ready to put on. Because it's within the weighing room, it's males only where the valets stay. Well, the women have their own changing room, but they feel they have to go in. Well, they didn't in my day, but they had to go in and get their saddles. So they sort of mixed together a bit.
How was it in your day?
In my day, it was a minority. I was in the 80s. I was basically the only woman basically riding, and I wasn't allowed anywhere near my toe in the weighing room. I had my changing room, and the valet used to come out and sort me out outside where the clerk of the scales was there, and away in front of the trainer. So it was very, very different.
And what was your own experience? Were you harassed?
I was sexually harassed on several occasions, brought down in races because they didn't want me to ride. Stewards were lords and sirs and they didn't want me there. I mean, basically very few women. They didn't want women to ride in races against men. It was the aces, you know, hey, it was the aces. I suffered depression from it, but I managed to pull through and it made me quite a strong person, probably a bit tough. But yeah, it was very, very tough. But, you know, that's decades ago. Yeah. I mean, now it shouldn't be happening now, not in this day and age. This shouldn't be happening. And for good of racing, the authorities are really looking into this and make it a more level playing field.
And Gay, you're standing by her. You're speaking out. You know, you've lived through it. You just explained that you were sexually harassed. Absolutely shocking in the 80s. Why isn't everybody standing with Bryony to say enough is enough? Is there still a fear?
I think there's still a bit of a fear of being unpopular. Some of the women haven't stuck with Bryony and they know it goes on. They know it goes on. They're cowards. They know it goes on. But they're in fear that they will make themselves unpopular and they don't want to get involved. I mean, you know, we need people to speak out. You know, a lot of people won't say anything. You know, some things are best not said and all that. But, you know, we need people like Bryony Frost, who's strong and comes out and says what's actually going on. So, and we can have change. And it's for, like I said, it's for good for racing. We'll have change for the better. And surely wouldn't it be better all round if people speak out, and so we get will be better facilities for women jockeys anyway.
Okay, I'm going to keep you there. I'm going to bring in Anna Marie Phelps, who's the chair of the British Horse Racing Authority. You're in meetings about this all day, Anna Marie. Obviously, it's very urgent. It's a very serious issue. It sounds like there's a problem of sexism, a culture of sexism.
Morning, Anita, and thanks for the opportunity to speak. And first of all, I'd just like to thank Bryony. Gay has mentioned her, but you know, if Bryony hadn't come forward and started this conversation, we're now in a much stronger position to try and move forward. It does sound like it's a sexist environment, and you know, I would say that one thing that we're really proud of in racing is that men and women compete on equal terms on the field of play once they're out on the turf. But that is not the same as men and women being treated equally across the sport. And there are, you know, big steps we need to make. I think we have come on leaps and bounds since Gay's time. I'm sure she would agree that the sport's moved forward, and we have some amazing pioneers and some hugely successful women now who are getting the best horses and top rides, and are, you know, transcend just horse racing, the likes of Rachel Blackmore and Holly Doyle alongside Bryony. So, you know, all of that is really positive, but that's not to take away from the seriousness of what's happened.
It sounds like Bryony and Gay and all the other women who are that are in the sport have succeeded despite the culture that's around them. Is the only factor that needs improving the weighing room culture? What else can be done to make the sport more inclusive?
No, I think there's plenty more. I mean, the facilities that we have for our female jockeys need to be bigger. If we want to encourage more women to come in, we need to be ensuring that we're creating larger and better changing rooms for them before they arrive, rather than waiting for them to come along. You know, the weighing room at the moment, and we need to completely redesign it. So a lot of our weighing rooms are very old, and it's a very old sport, and that is something that's changing. There's a plan to do that, but it's going to require a lot of investment, and it's a process that we've started at the moment. But the profile that our female jockeys are getting, it's really helped.
And what about changing the sort of culture and the mindset, Gay? Let me bring you back in, of everybody that's been in the sport for as long as they have been, who now need to shift their heads. Are things changing?
Oh, gosh, I've seen a lot of change. I mean, I've been training racehorses for 32 years, and I've seen a lot of change. And it's wonderful that I can embrace that. I've got two young apprentices, one male, one female, treated exactly the same in the stables. I mean, in my day, I was the only girl in my stable. You know, there was either the trainer's wife that rode out or the trainer's daughter. And I was lucky, I was a trainer's daughter, so I had the privilege of having that step in, whereas a lot of girls couldn't have that step. That was really tough for them, but you had to have a way in in my day. But now it's like with open arms, we do a lot for racing to bring young people into it. And but we, like you say, we want to make it more comfortable environment. And I think there's time for change, especially with the culture inside the weighing room. I think we need women valets. Why haven't we got women valets? There's a question there, you know, because, you know, there's like 25-30% of women riding now, and very successfully. Bryony won the Tingle Creek at Sandown on Saturday, where she got another standing ovation. You know, she was very well supported by the racing public. And I think, you know, like Anne Marie says, we are changing things, and we can see that, and there is time to move forward. And the, you know, some of these race courses that they still got the same changing rooms when I was riding back in the 80s. So we need a big uplift there.
So Anne Marie, what will be done? What changes can you implement? What will you be talking about in your meeting today?
Well, I think one of the most important things actually for us in racing is to try and bring the sport together to talk about what is acceptable and what's not acceptable, to have that really grown-up adult discussion. And it's only because of pioneers like Gay and Bryony speaking out that we can have that. And the support from across the sport, as Gay has said, both from owners and trainers and people across the administrative side of the sport, has been unbelievable for wanting to see that happen. So I think we've got a really good opportunity here to talk about behaviours. We can talk about facilities and we can change those things, are easy. Changing behaviours is something else. It's a really different level, and it's going to require real commitment from people, and it's going to require probably some regulative change as well. But it really does take time to do that. And that will happen as people change on and we move on. But we have to start now. And I think this is a great moment for us to do that.
Yeah, because even the phrase weighing room culture really kind of takes away from what we're talking about, which is sexism.
Yeah, I mean, the weighing room is not, I mean, it's not a terrible place to be. It's a place where elite athletes come together. And they can really build camaraderie there. But it is also, you know, a high octane sport. It's an area where tempers can get frayed and lines can get crossed. And what we need to make sure is that is an environment and there is a culture where people are comfortable. People like Bryony are comfortable putting their hand up and knowing that there won't be implications for them in the future, that they won't be ostracized. So, this is something that needs to happen more and more. And I really encourage people within racing, not just the jockeys, but other people that experience this sort of harassment or bullying, to come forward and to use RaceWise, which is our confidential reporting line, or to contact the BHA to do that. Because, you know, that's the only way we're going to have change, is if people speak out.
Anne-Marie Phelps and Gay Kellyway, thank you very much for joining me this morning. 84844 is the number to text if you want to contact me about anything you're hearing on the show today. Now, this week, ministers revealed a 10-year drug strategy allocating £780 million in funding for the drug treatment system in England. That includes an additional £300 million for combating more than 2,000 county lines gangs. County lines is a form of criminal exploitation where urban gangs persuade, coerce or force children and young people to store drugs and money and then transport them to suburban areas, market towns and coastal towns. The county line is both a reference to drugs being taken to different counties and the dedicated mobile phone lines used to sell drugs. It can happen in any part of the UK. It's against the law and it's a form of child abuse. Some victims of the crime are as young as 7. Well, joining me now to discuss this further are Sahira Irshad and Jen Jones, two mums from Sheffield whose family neighbourhoods and local communities have been impacted by county lines, and they're part of Mums United, a group of local mothers fighting against rising gang violence in Sheffield. Welcome to Woman's Hour, both of you. Sahira, I'm going to come to you first because you founded Mums United. Tell me more about it. What made you want to set this up?
Yeah, thank you for having us today. So Mums United was formed about 4 years ago now. I was born and raised in Sheffield, but I moved, I went to university, and from university I went to London. So 20 years later, I was raising two young children in the heart of London, and I was worried about the knife crime and the violence that I was seeing there. And I was concerned about, you know, there was postcode wars, area code wars, and young, predominantly men, fighting amongst each other. And I just wanted to raise my children in a safe environment. And the place where I associated with being safe and home was Sheffield. So I moved back, and there were other reasons as well, but that was predominantly the main reason. Yeah. I just wanted to come home to where I associated with feeling safe, and, you know, I had a good childhood here. So I moved back to Sheffield to be near my mum as well. And
was it safer? What happened when you got back?
It became quite apparent that the very reasons that I left London, those same reasons, you know, they were happening here in Sheffield. And, you know, I decided that, you know, I needed to actually do something about it. I saw a lot of mums, you know, I spoke to a lot of mums who were worried about young children engaging in the local gangs. They felt that their voices weren't being heard within their homes and within the community that they lived in. And as I got to know them and as I got to build a relationship with them, I just felt that we needed to do something more. And I didn't want it to be just a place where we just come and have a cup of tea. And, you know, I wanted to be more proactive. And that's in essence how Mums United was formed.
Well, what was your experience when you moved back to Sheffield? What did you see? What was happening?
So I saw, you know, drug dealing happening openly. I saw young children as young as 10, 11, engaging in drug activity. You know, they were clearly, you know, with groups of older boys in the parks. And this was happening openly, you know, taking packages. And, you know, when I spoke to local mums, they were like, yeah, this is what they do. You know, antisocial behaviour, young children just being rude, obnoxious. And it wasn't a nice place to be.
And it came to your doorstep?
Yeah, literally to my doorstep. And, you know, it was, people were carrying bags of weed quite openly and just, you know, open during the day, you know, as if it was just nothing. And, you know, taking out the packages. And, you know, there's a few times I confronted them about it.
You confronted the drug dealers?
Because I was just shocked. You know, this was happening near my children. And I asked them to move away from, you know, it was near my house. And they were just like, what are you going to do? You know, you're just a woman. So they were obnoxious and rude. But for me, it made me feel that, you know what, this can't happen. You know, I'm not going to have men like that talk to me in that way. And I need to protect my children. My children are growing up in this area. I can't keep on running away. Where am I going to run to? Mm. You know, it's time that we made a stand and as mothers, you know, have a voice.
Well, another mum that joined you is Jen, who's a volunteer with you at Mums United, but from a different part of the city to Sahara. Jen, how did you find out about it and what made you want to get involved?
Morning, Anita. Thanks for having us on today. The children are going to be so thrilled to hear that we've spoken to you. I live in a different area of Sheffield to Sahara. I live on a council estate in Sheffield and I'm a lone mum to two children. What happened was a couple of years ago now, before the pandemic, there was a shooting in my local community where a little boy was on his way to the local shop. And because there's two gangs having beef with each other, one member of one gang tried to shoot somebody else and the little boy got caught in the crossfire. This caused great alarm and distress for parents, all parents throughout our community. And we held a community meeting to which we invited the local MP, the councillors, the PCC and our local area, South Yorkshire Police team, as well as other community representatives. It was an open meeting, all residents were invited and the media. And most importantly, I had heard of Mums United Sheffield, which was really just starting up at the time, to be honest. Mm-hmm. But I'd heard of the ideas of what Mums United are trying to do over in the Sharrow area of Sheffield. And I thought, well, I'm going to be bold and ask them if they can come to this meeting to support us. And without hesitation, they said yes.
Jen, what you're saying is we need to hear everything you're saying. And I think we got clear that, you know, there was a shooting and a young boy got caught in the crossfire. Your line is a little bit fuzzy. We're just going to try and sort that out. Whilst we do that, I'm going to bring Sahara back in. I mean, that is really shocking to hear, but Jen, you know, had a meeting, got local councillors down and got you over there to see what you can do. What about within your own community? How did the mums react when you said, I want us to do something about this?
Initially, you know, a lot of the mums, they thought that it was going to be a place where they could sit and talk, have tea and samosas and pakoras, and you know, and which is fine, we do that anyway, but for me it was really kind of listening to their stories and listening to the way that they see themselves, you know, what place do they have in the communities that we live in. So it was a case of you know, a lot of mums came together. There was a lot of resistance from you know, from certain members of the community. They didn't want us to talk. They didn't want us to take ownership of the issues that we were having. So there has been a resistance, but there's been a lot of support as well.
Jen, let's bring you back in. I mean, Boris has said we've already rolled up 1,500 county lines gangs, but we still need to do 2,000 more. As a mother on the ground, what needs to happen? What would you like to see happen?
What we're currently seeing happen up to this point is that the authorities target and pick up the young people who have been victim to being groomed by these criminal gangs to become drug runners, carry guns, store drugs, store guns, knives and weapons, and so on and so forth. And yes, while they are committing crimes, they are also victims. But what we're not seeing happen is the people who are conducting all of this. And let's face it, in reality, this is grown adult, in the majority, men, who are behind all of this that's happening to our children. And another important thing, Anita, is that to these grown adults who are puppeteering the children, and predominantly poor working class children, or children with disabilities like autism and ADHD, who are very vulnerable to being groomed, that's children just like my own son, which is another reason why I'm so adamant and so passionate to be supporting, and as much as I can, everything that Mums United and similar projects are doing. These people need to be picked up and removed, rather than, of course, it's important that there are plans in place to support people who are using the drugs and for them to be rehabilitated. I accept that and I acknowledge that. But what we don't have are things like safe, supervised, responsibly run activities for youths where there are crime hotspots. And the other thing is, the most saddening and heartbreaking thing of all of this is that when there's a young boy in a pool of his own blood on a pavement on a council estate somewhere because gangs have had beef with each other, and he's dying and crying for his mum, the man behind whatever has happened, the grown adult people who have conducted all of this situation, are wiping their hands of that child and saying, where do we get another one from? Because our children are dispensable to the people behind these county lines crimes.
And it's deeply personal for you, because you said, as you said, your own son is quite vulnerable. He has autism. How old is he?
My son's 10 and he attends a special school. And currently, all of the children at the special school get wanded, you know, with a metal detector on a morning and at lunchtimes. Their belongings and their lunch packs are wanded with a metal detector because there have now been older children who are already being targeted to be groomed and to become drug runners and criminals by these gangs, have been found to have brought bladed articles into school this year. Very recently, it's happened on two occasions that we know of, because the school does obviously let parents know. And whereas I appreciate that, it is also incredibly alarming.
So the government is investing this £300 million to tackle drug supply and county lines over the next 3 years. But they've also separately allocated £4.8 million for the development of the South Yorkshire Violence Reduction Unit to identify and respond to the root causes of violent crime. But for you, it can't happen quick enough, can it?
No, it really can't. I mean, for myself, Anita, just to put you in the full picture, I've been a qualified play worker since 1998 with advanced level play work. And what we do see is we sometimes see small community projects that are called youth provisions, but really it is just unqualified but well-meaning volunteers. What we need the government to do with that violence reduction fund, and I will ask South Yorkshire Police, come and talk to Mums United, help us and fund and grow what we're doing and put these things in place in other areas of the city, because it is so sorely needed, but do so with fully qualified play workers, youth mentors, or provide training schemes for volunteer parents and volunteers from the community to get these qualifications so that we can put these things in place in our communities before another child dies or ends up in prison.
Well, they've got a place to come to, haven't they? Mums United. Thank you, Sahira Ershad and Jen Jones, for talking to me this morning. Now, next week, we want to hear from you. if you are a grandparent. We'd love to know if you're doing a lot of childcare for your grandkids so that mum and dad can go to work. If so, what's the cost to you? We want to hear from you financially, emotionally, and in terms of your time. Is it worth every second, or do you wish you weren't relied on so much? Get in touch in the usual ways. Drop us an email by going to our website. And of course, keep messaging me, 84844. Mums United are an amazing grassroots organisation in Sheffield and have done some great work to safeguard young people. Keep up the great work, Jen and Sahira. And that's a message that's just come in. Now, we had Storm Arwen a few weeks ago and Storm Barra this week. I do hope you've been wrapping up warm in your hat, of course, scarf, yes, and most importantly, gloves. From hand-knitted mittens to seductive satin numbers to Bluetooth-enabled gloves that function like mobile phones. There's an extraordinary variety of gloves out there for us to choose from. Their powers have extended to marriage, magic, and even murder. In January 2020, Vogue magazine announced that opera gloves are fast becoming Hollywood's favourite accessory. Well, Dr. Anne Green is an emeritus professor of French at King's College London and has just released her new book, Gloves, An Intimate History, and joins us now to tell us more about them. Welcome to Woman's Hour HQ.
Thank you.
Why did you want to write this fascinating book, Anne?
Well, I originally came across I wasn't particularly interested in gloves at all, but I was looking at Flaubert's notebooks, a 19th century novelist, and in his notebook there's a little jotting headed Theory of the Glove. And he talks about gloves being really quite creepy because they move like a hand and yet they're not a hand. He says there's nothing so unsettling as a gloved hand. And I started looking at, you know, how gloves were written about, and then it all moved on from there and expanded and snowballed and eventually turned into a book that starts off with Tutankhamun's
yes.
gloves in the pyramids and goes up to the... to now.
As you said, it spans the fluctuating history of gloves and how they've fallen in and out of fashion, all the various uses. They were particularly fashionable in the 16th century and then in the 19th. And now we are seeing a glove renaissance. They're such a simple staple in a wardrobe, but for some reason gloves have fluctuated in popularity over time. Why is that?
Well, I think ordinary gloves have always been there, gloves for protecting your hands from the cold or from injury. But in the 16th and particularly the 17th century, the gloves were a tremendous status symbol. So these were not just ordinary gloves. They were gloves that had most beautiful flamboyant decoration, lots of embroidery and ribbons and sequins. And they weren't always necessarily worn. They were they could be carried just to show off that you were, a person of high status. So it that kind of glove would only have been worn by a relatively small proportion of the population. And in the 19th century, you get a huge shift. There's a change in technology, so gloves start being produced more rapidly. And also with a shift in population, people moving from a sort of peasant life into cities, they want to adopt middle-class mores, and they all start to want to have gloves. So a huge boom in glove making and in all the etiquette that went along with wearing gloves. So in the 19th century, people were wearing gloves, you know, virtually as soon as you stepped out of the house. You had to have your glove already on and properly buttoned up. And most sophisticated people would change their gloves 4, 5, 6 times a day.
4 or 5? How many gloves would you have in your drawers?
Well, you bought them by the dozen and huge numbers.
And gloves can have a power of their own if they're worn by certain people, can't they? I'm thinking of the sort of 60s in America. Jackie Kennedy wearing gloves, and is a quote in the book. It's a passage from American Pastoral by the American writer Philip Roth, where he talks about Jackie Kennedy walked out there with a glove on her wrist and a glove to the elbow, and all of a sudden gloves were in style again.
Yes, I mean, gloves were starting to be I mean, they were much less worn than in the 19th century. And yes, that point that's been made in the novel is that she kind of gives a little fillip to glove wearing. But the 60s is really when society changes. Kennedy dies in 1963. That was just a little blip, I think. And then after that, you get a decline in glove wearing. You certainly wouldn't wear gloves in the, you know, the middle of the summer anymore.
And there's also a very feminine power to the energy of gloves, isn't there? The idea that gloves had been invented by Venus, the goddess of love,
yes.
You tell us. And also there's a fabulous photograph, even the photo is seductive, of Rita Hayworth in the film Gilda, when she seductively removes a glove.
Yes, a sort of striptease as she sings. Yes, I mean, gloves have... I think it's because gloves come in pairs, so a matching pair implies a, you know, sort of matching couple. So yes, they've been associated with love and courtship. They were a very common present to give on Valentine's Day. Men would give gloves to their sweethearts. And gloves were given as love tokens and keepsakes. And then particularly in the 19th century, you have this flirtatious gesture of dropping a glove. A woman could drop a glove in front of somebody she was interested in the hope that he would pick it up and then a conversation could start. So that's a very flirtatious gesture.
It is a fascinating book, and you get into all sorts of insights. We didn't even get to talk about Elsa and the froze magic of gloves.
Oh, the magic of gloves, yeah. Yes, well, there's a whole lot of superstition and, you know, folklore about gloves operating in a magical way. I think because they're considered to be so much part of the person. So Elsa's glove, yes, it acts as a very magical barrier between her magic powers and the outside world.
Yes.
But there are lots of other magic gloves that behave in strange and wonderful ways, and they're the ones that can actually commit murder.
Well, on that cliffhanger, it's out now, Gloves, An Intimate History. Anne Green, thank you very much for joining me to talk to me about that. Fascinating stuff. And there you go. If you were thinking about needed some inspiration as to what to buy somebody for Christmas, gloves. I just want to read out this Home Office statement in terms of County Line's drugs gangs. The government is investing £300 million to tackle drug supply and County Line's over the next 3 years, and has also separately allocated £4.8 million for the development of the South Yorkshire Violence Reduction Unit to identify and respond to the root causes of violent crime. Now, to a podcast series that has been drawing attention to the internet phenomenon of catfishing, the practice of using a fake profile to start an online relationship. Sweet Bobby tells the story of Kirat Assi, a 42-year-old radio presenter who meets a handsome cardiologist, Bobby, through Facebook. Over almost a decade, they develop a friendship and then a relationship over phone and messenger apps. He moves to New York while she is based in London. However, their relationship gradually begins to deteriorate. And when he visits London but refuses to see her, she learns that Bobby is not who he says he is. Well, earlier I spoke to Kirat about her experience alongside investigative journalist Alexi Mostras, the presenter of Sweet Bobby. We should clarify that although there are real-life versions of Bobby and some of the characters described by Kirat, the references in the interview are to fake characters played by the catfisher and to fake life events. Bear in mind that the interview potentially includes spoilers, so do switch off if you don't want to discover the identity of the catfisher. But first, to Kirat. I asked her how she met Bobby back in November 2010.
I met Bobby a year after I started talking to his younger brother, who'd approached me as the boyfriend of one of my cousins, who he'd had a bit of an argument with her, and he was hoping that I would give him some tips to get back with her. Much, much younger than me. He passed away, and the brother then got in touch with me to say thank you for being a big sister figure to my younger brother. And that's where the conversations with him started. He was a married man with a kid on the way. I was in a relationship. There was no sign of anything.
So Bobby is a real person that you know from your kind of social circle, and you thought he'd got in touch with you to talk about the death of his younger brother. He'd reached out to you.
Yeah, he's in the community, East African, South Asian community. I know of his family really well. I know some of them really well. I had pictures with some of them on my social media at the time. So I knew of him. I didn't know him personally.
And then you developed a friendship online.
Yeah, that just slowly developed. He just kept on talking to me. It was more like being pen pals. We'd talk occasionally. He'd reach out to me. And I just respectfully, politely respond. It was a very respectful relationship.
So you kind of make building this relationship, talking to somebody online, but then you met him in person at a party, the actual Bobby.
I did. I didn't expect to. I was on a hen weekend in Brighton. I saw him walk across the club and I followed him. But it was like, I think, 1 or 2 in the morning, quite rowdy in there. And he responded. He wasn't nasty or anything, but he didn't recognise me. He was quite blank. And I was just like, you know, forget it. I don't want to embarrass him, because he might be just very drunk. And it was difficult to hear, and I was out with the girls, so I let it go.
So then you kept in touch with this guy online, and then he disappeared for a while, and you heard that he died. But then he reappeared in witness protection.
But yeah, he passed away, and he reappeared, and his ex-wife went out to see him. And then I was told via her, via my cousin, that he was alive, which to me was, you know, I was only in the periphery of his life, like he was in the periphery of mine. So it was just a crazy story that you share with your friends, right? Like, what the hell? So that's all it was. I was shocked. But it wasn't any of my business because he wasn't anybody close to me.
So how did it go from, like you say, this bizarre twists and turns of this chap called Bobby who had died in Kenya that then came back, was back alive, but in witness protection in America? How did it go from just stories that you talked to your friends about to actually being in a relationship with him?
So lots of things happened. He became really, really unwell. He and his wife, ex-wife, I don't know what she was at the time, split up. But then one day when he was very unwell in the hospital, he told me he had feelings for me, which was really strange because before that, he always called me his big sister. So it was really, really strange. And I was like, you're just unwell. You don't have feelings for me. I'm just, you know, just mistaking me being there for you and helping you out and listening to you as something else. And yeah, I just, from there, it was just a lot of pressure. His illness, he became paralyzed. He was leaning on me and people around him, including his consultant. His cousins were all saying, you know, he really, really loves you. He really, really loves you. So after many months, it was just a kind of, well, maybe he's only got a few months left of his life to live. I'd been told he wasn't going to live beyond July 2015. And I was kind of just making a dying man happy. Nothing was going to physically happen between us. I don't know if I was going to see him. It was just, you know, I wasn't ready to be in another relationship, so to speak. Mm. So I was just going to make a dying man happy, and I cared about him.
How would you actually spend time together?
Yeah, so we'd play like online Scrabble. We'd have like date nights. We'd watch like Apprentice every week. He was introducing me to his family. And
on WhatsApp, right?
It was on Facebook Messenger. It was on WhatsApp.
But they were all made up people. That none of these people existed.
Yes, there were real life versions of some of these people, right, who I knew. So I thought I was talking to people that I knew of, some of them, and some of them I didn't know. Once we were in the sort of romantic relationship side of things, it was, you know, planning for the, once we knew he wasn't going to die, who's making a recovery, planning for the future. But otherwise, it was just, you know, house hunting. We shared an interest in food.
Kira, planning for the future, like you were going to get married. What was happening? This person had said you were going to get married. And
so he'd be sending me pictures of, you know, I think you should be wearing this colour because I really like you in this colour in your other pictures. And you know, that kind of thing. And sending
what, like
me
planning
venues.
Planning the wedding.
Pretty much. Yeah, pretty much sending me pictures of outfits that he, you know, outfits that he might want to wear, locations for weddings. Also house hunting. He didn't want to come back to the house that he had here. He wanted to have a different house. Talking about his career going forward, if he could salvage it or not.
So you were having your perfect relationship in a way.
Yeah.
It is so shocking to hear, isn't it, Alexi? I mean, I've listened to the podcast, Kira, and we're going to get into it a little bit more. But Alexi, it's just like you say at the beginning of the podcast, it's a story that has to be heard to believed.
it is quite an interesting process, both for me as a reporter and for listeners, hopefully, on the podcast, because you do start off with this potential presumption that Kirat has been a bit gullible, you know, someone entering into quite an intimate relationship without even demanding a video call or anything like that. You start off potentially from that position. But the more you understand about how it works, the more sympathy you have for how this whole thing happened. Mm. I mean, for one thing, although there were quite a lot of online personalities that Kirat was interacting with, there was one person in the real world who was telling her that all this was true. And it was a person that she trusted implicitly. And unless psychologically you make the decision not to trust that person, then it kind of gives a stamp of authority and approval for everything else that you're experiencing. The catfisher was so sophisticated in their approach that you almost kind of stand back in disbelief and sort of this weird kind of admiration almost for the creativity. There was this one time when fake Bobby got in touch with Kirat and said, why don't we pick out some baby clothes for my son? So they went on a website and they picked out some baby clothes. And then 2 weeks later or so, Kirat gets this picture of Bobby's son wearing the clothes that they picked out. Now, that's a real picture of a real child wearing the clothes that you picked out on the website. Like, it's wow. Real, right? Mm. But it turns out that what we think happened was that the catfisher somehow obtained a picture of Bobby's son, worked out where the clothes he was wearing came from. They must have Googled it, found it, and then reverse engineered the whole situation so that Kirat believed that she was spontaneously picking out clothes with Bobby. This wasn't an isolated incident mm-hmm. either. So if you add all of these up, that you can begin to see how even kind of relatively superficially unbelievable situations like the witness protection program became realistic and believable.
Especially if you have a real person in real life that you are talking to who seems to be backing things up. How did the nature of the relationship, Kirat, change?
I mean, it was initially controlling, which you think is in a nice way because he's love bombing you. And because he was so unwell, you'd feel like, oh my God, he's so unwell and yet he's still thinking about me and he's doing all these lovely things for me. But once I started questioning him, it slowly became more and more abusive and controlling. You know, but think of silly things like I wasn't even allowed to go to the bathroom without him knowing. If I was online, I was having to sleep with him with headphones on. Initially, it was for medical reasons. And afterwards, he was just, you know, had mental health issues. He was depressed. You know, I got told off once terribly just for going to the bathroom for 2 minutes in the middle of the night without telling him.
So what impact was this having on your life?
I mean, it was really, really difficult. Every part of my life was slowly being destroyed. I'd already started losing huge amounts of weight. I was always stressed. I wasn't able to socialise. I didn't go out anywhere in the evenings. I wasn't really allowed to talk to my friends. I was always, he knew absolutely everything mm. about me.
And then you discovered who it was.
Yes.
And who was it?
It was my cousin. It was my cousin.
Are you okay?
Yeah, I'm okay. Sorry, it's just, yeah. I mean, what do you say to that?
It was the cousin that you'd been talking to and confiding in and who was your person in real life that you were talking to about this whole situation. It turned out to be the same young woman.
It was the cousin who I just, you know, initially spoken to who I thought was her boyfriend to protect her. So I just, you know, looked out for her as I do with all my cousins, as they will know. Sometimes I might be the big sister figure. And she knew that about me. And I was very protective of her. Even the morning of the confession, I was like, you know, you're so bright. I felt so bad. She's so bright. She's such an amazing young woman. I was like, you've been had as well. You've been taken in by all of this as well. I was still sympathizing with her and feeling bad for her too.
Did you ever speak to him? Did you ever hear his voice?
Absolutely, yes. I was speaking to him from mid-2015.
So your cousin was putting on a voice?
Yes, and there is a story behind that because everyone wants to know how she put that voice on. He'd lost his voice in the stroke, so it took many months for him well, to recover.
She'd thought about everything, basically. She'd thought about every angle and had something to say. Honestly, the twists and turns, and we do really feel for you, Kirit, throughout the whole podcast. Alexei, tell us about the current laws around catfishing. What are they, and were you surprised by them?
The current legal framework in the UK does not make catfishing in and of itself a criminal offence. So you can con someone for 10 years using fake identities and cause them great psychological harm, and potentially there's no breach of the criminal law involved. I mean, obviously, if you con someone out of money, then there's certain fraud charges, but catfishing in and of itself isn't illegal.
It really is a remarkable lesson. And I just want to know, Kirit, how are you now?
I'm kind of glad it's out in the open, because I've been doing everything in silence. I've not been able to speak about it because I've been judged for not being, you know, I've lost my career. I've lost everything that I had. I'm slowly rebuilding my life, but I've not been able to speak about any work that I've been doing, just in case. I've not been able to speak about what happened to me because people judge me. Like that whole victim shaming or treat me like I'm strange. There's been all of that. So in a way, I'm glad it's out there, but I'm just taking one day at a time. It happened 3.5 years ago. So in terms of the immediate trauma, I've dealt with that and I have my mechanisms for coping. But, you know, you still have moments. My last two nights I've suffered with nightmares, but I'm back to more or less my bubbly self, and it's just about rebuilding the rest of my life again now.
And Alexei, you say at the beginning of the podcast that people who you talk to who are over 40 found it unbelievable and really questioned how somebody could allow this to happen. But people under that age seem to understand.
It's just a sense from speaking to people that people under the age of 40 who have grown up online, who have grown up with social media, are very, very comfortable with the idea of forming relationships digitally. And they don't really have this kind of divide between the relationships that they form online and the relationships that they form in real life. And it's this kind of coming together of these two different types of relationships and the blurring of these lines that potentially creates more scope for abuse and manipulation.
And Alexei, what impact do you hope the podcast will have?
I hope it'll help people in similar situations. We've been contacted by dozens, like more than 25 people have got in touch with us since the podcast came out, saying that they've been catfished. I mean, including, you know, one really high profile actress who seems to have gone through a very similar experience to other people who were catfished by relatives. And it seems like there's a potential for abuse here. Lots of people might be suffering it, and yet there is no kind of regulatory or legal structure to prevent it from happening. So if we can get a conversation going around that, then I think that Kirit particularly has done quite a lot.
That was Alexei Mostras and Kirit Assi, and the full story can be heard in the podcast series Sweet Bobby by Tortoise Media. Kirit's cousin has provided a statement. She says, "This matter concerns a family dispute over events that began over a decade ago when I was a schoolgirl. As far as I'm concerned, this is a private family matter that's been resolved, and I strongly object to the numerous unfounded and seriously defamatory accusations that have been made about me, as well as details of private matters that have been shared with the media." 84844 is the number to text. Now, we continue our look at alternative food ideas for Christmas with chef, food writer and owner of Caribe, Keshia Sakara. She celebrates the diverse cuisine of the Caribbean and representing dishes from across the region. Keshia, welcome. Welcome to Woman's Hour. Where did your passion for food come from?
Firstly, thank you for having me. Just growing up, I spent a lot of time with my grandparents, my grandmothers on both sides, just loved to cook, and they presented it to me in a really positive way. And I just think, being a creative child, I kind of just absorbed myself in it. And by the time I had to start thinking of a career, I couldn't think of anything else, really.
It was always going to be food.
I think so.
And so how easy, difficult was it for you to gain access to the food industry?
Looking back now, I would say it was quite hard. I think firstly, for females in general in the food world, it's very male dominated, as we know. If you look at most of the prominent chefs on TV, they are male. Also, to see brown women in food, I just didn't see myself. And I remember telling my mum around 14 I wanted to be a chef. And purely out of love, she kind of just didn't agree because she didn't see it as a feasible job. because we couldn't see a positive example of it. So I really feel like I've had to craft it myself, and it's evolved in so many ways, in so many positive ways. But that just started off with me actually having the confidence to be an entrepreneur, I guess, and a business person. So then I could then curate it myself. So I'm glad that I had that kind of drive to make it what I wanted it to be.
And now you have Caribe in Pop Brixton.
Yes, I do.
Which is doing very well, because the reason I know about you is because friends of mine who've eaten your food have raved about it. And told me I have to get down there. So let's talk about food, and let's talk about your own heritage, because your family is from Montserrat and Barbados. So it's also
Montserrat and Barbados. So they're both tiny islands next to Antigua. Montserrat is still actually a part of the British colony, and Barbuda is the sister island to Antigua. And they both have their own cultures.
And so how has understanding the food of those islands helped you understand your own culture?
It's helped me understand my own culture because the stories that are connected with the food are twinned with the history. So, for example, Montserrat, the national dish is goat water, which I absolutely love. And growing up in Leicester, there was a smaller Caribbean population, but goat water would be cooked at like funerals and weddings. It's basically like an Irish stew, but it uses goat meat instead of beef, and it's got loads of aromatics and spices in it.
Yes, aromatic spices. I want to get to Christmas. I'm just one eye on the time, that's all. Okay. Tell us what you'll be cooking at Christmas. Let's get some of these delicious dishes.
Christmas, I'll definitely be making sorrel. So that's like similar to hibiscus, and it's a drink, and you boil it with like ginger, loads of spices. That's absolutely delicious. And then black cake is always there, which is just like a sweet cake with fruits soaked from the year before in lots of alcohol and again lots of spices. Both grandmas always make them, and that's one of my favorite things to eat now.
Ooh, and what's souse?
Souse is actually like pickled pork, which originated during enslavement it's kind of brined in like a vinegar and a little bit of salt, and then you serve it with a cucumber kind of relish on the side. And that's like hundreds of years old, and we still eat it today.
And will this be food that sits alongside sort of turkey and all the trimmings in your household?
Definitely. So as much as you'll have like roast potato and turkey and stuff, we'll have rice and coleslaw and everything else. And that's just like our British Caribbean crossover at home, really.
And what goes into black cake? This sounds delicious.
So you have the dried fruit, so raisins, sultanas, all of that. You soak that in the alcohol and it just like rehydrates them kind of.
What alcohol?
And it has a cake base.
Details of the alcohol. Is it rum or what alcohol goes into it? Any alcohol?
You can use rum. Some people use sherry. Any kind of like brown liquor, really.
What advice would you give to someone who's starting out in the food industry now? As someone who's done really well, you know, you've got entrepreneurial spirit. Caribe is serving up delicious food. What advice would you give to someone else who wants to start out?
I would say just find something that you're really passionate about and that you can connect with, because I feel like what motivates me is that I believe in this a lot. So even when, you know, I find that I'm meeting any adversities or difficulties, I stay true to it because I really believe in it. Build an audience, because I feel like the people that you're speaking to, if they engage with it in the same way you do, then they will help push it for you and it will grow organically.
And we've had a tweet from someone saying when our children were young, they didn't like turkey. So we have we change it every year. One year we have paella tapas. The other year we had homemade KFC style fried chicken. Another year was a Japanese theme. Give them a suggestion for what they can do this year.
Duck. I really like duck. Can brine that nicely overnight in a little salt and sugar, maybe some five spice on it and roast it slowly. That's alternative.
Sounds absolutely delicious. Keshia, thank you very much for speaking to me on Woman's Hour. And we've also had this last email saying, I'm currently in quarantine in Hong Kong where incoming travellers have to stay in a hotel. My quarantine has been extended to 3 weeks. So sadly, I'll be missing Christmas Day with my husband. To cheer my children up, I'll be making them a quarantine advent calendar every day out of something Christmassy. The example is attached. And I think it's a toilet roll holder. How very inventive. Thank you for joining me. Join me tomorrow for Weekend Woman's Hour. That's all for today's Woman's Hour. Join us again next time.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.